Hey guys, this is And the Writer Is, and I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special events, or buy some of our merchandise, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Oh, and if you enjoy this podcast, please rate us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. We really appreciate that effort.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to season number 2. First of all, thank you to all of our listeners for making us one of the hottest new music podcasts in the industry with over 500,000 downloads and counting. We've been getting tons of feedback from our emails and social media, and we appreciate all of your enthusiasm and your willingness to spread the word. So thanks again. Thanks for rating us on iTunes. All of that's been very helpful. We are starting this season off with Jack Antonoff. Jack currently has the hottest song on radio with Taylor Swift's Look What You Made Me Do, which is currently top 10 and was only released 3 weeks ago. He co-produced and co-wrote the Lorde album Melodrama. He co-produced and co-wrote the upcoming St. Vincent album. And if that wasn't impressive enough, he also released his second album as the frontman of Bleachers, Gone Now. So without further ado, here is And the Writer Is featuring Jack Antonoff. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. This week's writer, producer, artist, philanthropist is one of my favorite humans in the game. See, everyone agrees that the music industry is uber competitive, but a true artist only competes with his or herself. And this man has written and produced songs only he could write and produce. And as an artist, he releases songs only he can release. From V, New Jersey, this writer fights for gender equality and for the LGBTQ community. And the writer is the guy I almost text every day because his name is alphabetically next to my wife's, Jack Antonoff.
I didn't know that.
Dude, I can't tell you how many times I'm about to text you a picture of my dog.
Like, or your dick.
Yeah, right. Or my dog. Yeah. It is actually pretty funny. So let's go to how it all began for you.
You were there.
Well, that's true. Kind of. I mean, I missed the whole steel train.
Oh, yeah. You were there.
I was there-ish.
Oh, like way back.
I don't know. Okay. So, well, look, you tour around with a trailer that looks like your bedroom.
Is.
Is. That is your actual bedroom.
It's
actual.
It's important to work on projects that financially cripple you.
Wait, do you sleep in that?
No, I just wanted, I thought, so the long and the short of that project is I love how quickly things move nowadays. Streaming, you get a song blasted out to the world immediately, but I wanted the other side too. And I wrote, you know, like I'm sure you have a space where you write a lot of music. I'm not a very big hippie, but I think like the atmosphere of it gets charged. Like you charge it with these songs. Like it's the same way that if you're in a great studio where this happened, like my version of that, my Abbey Road is my bedroom. That's where I write all the songs. And so I wanted to play my new album for people, fans in that room.
Incredible.
And it's important. That's the only, I think that's important to, cause I know you've had a million experiences like this too. There's so many things in music and art where you have an idea and someone's like, but you're not going to make money. In fact, you're going to lose money. and then you get caught up in that game. But that's not why any of us started. No one in this room or in any studio you walked into is there because they wanted to get rich. They would have sold washing machines or stocks, which is such an important thing to constantly go back to because there's other people in our business that are there to get rich.
So when you are building a trailer using your furniture from your childhood room, and you're in that room playing the music, you know, the new album for your fans, are you listening to it like you were 15? Like, do you find yourself like listening to your own album like you're a fan? Or does that put you in that place, or are you able to sort of differentiate you as the writer and the artist from?
I'm pretty far from it now. The idea of the project was sort of about giving it away. Like, the album and a lot of my work in general is about moving on. Like, I think I write a lot, no matter what I write about, like, what part of you froze? What part of you is unfrozen? Like, you know, because that's sort of interesting to me in general, like, which part of you is dancing into the future and which part of you is stuck in the past? So I like the absurdity of, like, you know, trying to move on. Well, here's the most absurd way of not moving on. So I'm pretty far from it. I'm even thinking about, like, maybe I'll, like, blow it up in some grand gesture. But once I put something out, I usually get far enough from it.
You mean, like, put dynamite in that old bedroom
and
blow it up for real?
Just in like, you know, might as well race all the way down this road of complete absurd energy.
Are you working in a way to impress that kid or something?
Yeah. I'm very, I don't know if you had this. I don't know who told me I couldn't do it because it wasn't my parents. They were great. Maybe it was school because I didn't do well, but I have this sense that someone told me I couldn't do it. And when I say it, I mean all of it. You know, make a living, write songs, perform, feed myself, have like a healthy mind and body. Like, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's a Jewish thing. I'm railing against that. And in that intro that you read was very nice, but it is that when you said being competitive, it's like, that's the person I'd like to be kinder to is myself. I'm not really looking at anyone else, but I don't know who gave me such a chip.
Yeah. I pretty much have had like one therapy session and this person said to me, it was like, you know, I have a lot of issues with 16-year-old me. Like 16, 17-year-old, I wasn't the best part of my life. And he's like, you know, you can go back to that guy and like hold his hand. Like if you go back, what would you say to that guy? You know?
Or how do you forgive him for being
interesting.
Not great?
Was your 16, 17-year-old self not great?
Just like not inspiring on the way I wanted to be, not like...
What would you have done differently?
Nothing in hindsight. Uh-huh. But at the time, like, I wanted to make better music. I wanted to reach people. I wanted to, like, I just wanted to exist and to, I don't know, I just wanted to create more. And I didn't know how to do it. And I was, like, stealing shit.
Wait, what do you mean?
I was, like, into theft.
Like, you ever get caught?
Yeah, I got arrested.
Really?
Or, like, the under 18 version of arrested.
What were you stealing?
Well, I was very like political about it. I would only steal from big corporations,
right?
But I stole a lot of like it was like real sport. It was like something my friends and I got into.
Yeah, we used to steal CDs from Borders.
Yeah,
which is gone now. So I think if it's not Borders, gone. Send me an email. Like, I'll send you like
if there's a
25
Borders,
bucks or whatever for the CDs that we used to steal. But actually, they were probably 25 bucks a piece.
You know? That was a weird time.
Yeah.
But or just like the concept of like, not to get super therapy, but like even nowadays, like I'm obsessed with, and I keep wanting to use this as a lyric and I can't find a space. So I don't know what it is yet, but we would never, like a decent human being, you know, a non-Bannon would never speak to another person the way they speak to themselves.
Decent person
would never speak to you, would never talk to me the way that you used to talk to yourself.
Oh, wow.
Think about the way that you, like if you don't, if you do something wrong, if you're not A-okay, if you, you know, fuck something up, think about the way you treat yourself. And that I think is, I've been trying to write that song for a long time. I don't have the lyric.
Is that a universal thing?
I think it is. I think everyone treats themselves, not necessarily like utter shit, like I don't think we're all abusing ourselves, but I do think that we all have a very hard time treating ourselves like a friend.
Who?
What's that lyric? Like, I wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean,
I would never talk to you like I talk to me. It's too chunky, right? It doesn't say.
Well,
it all.
It's weird because you're the antagonist in it, which I like. I never want the listener to be the antagonist.
Totally.
So if you're talking about, either you're talking in the third person, where you're saying like, in a way, don't treat me how you treat you.
Don't treat me. That's nice. Ooh, that's good.
Maybe we'll use that.
Don't treat me like you treat. Or I wonder, or is it just like maybe I can't write it because I'm trying to make it like a hook, and maybe it's just like a weird passing lyric where it's like, what did he just say? Did he just say that really profound thing in like, you know, the third verse or something?
Right.
But I love the concept. But I'm sure you are like that too. It's like I have like certain flags in my head that I haven't written yet. That's a big one.
Yeah.
Like, why am I so mean to myself? I'm not a mean person.
Who sets your like level of, I don't know. We were just talking about where you raise your bar, you know, wherever you set your bar and you aim for it. Who set your bar so high? Was it you? Were your parents? I mean, I think also as like a Jewish kid growing up, I felt certainly in my family that everyone was an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And so I felt like I was failing if I couldn't feed myself in doing what I was doing.
Yeah, well,
I remember having the conversation early on in my career, telling my mom not to tell people I'm a struggling musician and to just describe me as a musician.
I had that conversation.
You know, that adjective, really.
Yeah, like friends and family can look at my bank statement at another time, but regardless of what's happening there, I am a musician.
Right. And that is the pursuit. And to be honest, like if you're in, you know, if you're a resident as a doctor, you know, before you become a doctor, you know, you're not making any money doing that either.
And but everyone's proud of you.
But everyone's proud of you because you're...
Well, I think what pisses people off about artists is... They're you know, no one's like, I'm gonna go to college, I'm gonna become an artist and shoot out a few kids and just be an artist for the rest of my life. Like, right. You know, no one's ever said that. So I think it inherently pisses people off when you go for it.
Yeah.
Because that's the whole story of life is trying to go for it. But there is something Jewish there, because you touched on it a second ago. Sorry, I wanted to go back to it. I did grow up with this feeling. World War II and the Holocaust is so present for Jews. So as far as that bar goes, like there was this, not like invisible thought, but this like straight from my grandfather was like, yo, I got here in the craziest way. Like escaped fucking Europe, moved to Denver with no money, went back to Europe to liberate the camps, moved to New York City, like 13 people living in like an East Village apartment, sleeping in drawers, literally, just so your mother could go to college. And now you better not fuck this up. So it's a weird thing. And I think it's post depression mentality for Americans. I think it's post World War II mentality for Jews and Europeans. But it's this like, we worked so hard so you could do whatever you want. So by all means, be an artist, do whatever you want, but don't you fuck it up. Because, you know, we didn't do this. So I always had the sense that like, if I'm gonna try this thing, oh my God, I better not disappoint the people who, you know, didn't like put in a hard day's work to get me here, but like, you know, like fled war and like, you know, slept on the floor. Yeah. And you know, success for my grandfather's generation was to be alive as a Jew. Success for my mother's generation was to have food on the table. So I'm this lucky generation where they're like, okay, we worked so hard so you could actually have a choice. So I do feel this insane pressure. I think it's why Jews are so jittery.
I laugh at that. My company's name is Papa Tibor Incorporated. You know, that all my music goes through my grandpa.
Yeah.
You know, who, same sort of thing, barely escaped. And it was like, it felt like, I look at every statement I get is written to that. I mean, all the checks, every contract
is
written.
Shira Lee Lawrence, that's my parents.
Yeah, crazy. Are your grandparents proud of you?
Well, I have one grandmother left who's extremely proud. But
the grandparents aren't here.
The grandparents have departed over the past decade.
Do you have any conversations with them in a way?
I think they are proud, and I think it's the only time that I ever care about financial stability. Because I toured so unsuccessfully for so long, you know, had to be supported, had to ask my parents for money, had to not move out of my house for a very long time. I really had a lot of peace with that because I really believed in making work. But every once in a while, you know, now that I've been able to support myself, I don't really care about that stuff, but I care about it only because I can see my grandfather being like, you know, we worked so hard just to get to America to try to live the American dream, and you're getting your piece of it.
Yeah.
Because that's the real American dream, right? To work incredibly hard through generations and to be able to provide for, you know, your generations to come. So that's the only time I care about that stuff is like, because they weren't money focused. I mean, they lived in like a tiny house in Burlington, Vermont. The guy was a rabbi. You know, it's not like an ace way to get rich. But that makes me proud. Because they were, yeah. I think there was concern for a long time with good reason. When you're an artist, sometimes the universe yells at you to stop. How many shows did you play where, you know, it's not like, oh, there wasn't a great crowd. Like, there was no crowd.
No one. They were the only audience member is the bartender.
That's not like...
Or the band that's either closing or opening for you, if they were willing to stand there.
The universe by all standards is yelling in your face, like, please stop. Like, we're asking you, like, if there's a God, God did not send people to my show. God did not put money in my bank account. Like, if I was a religious person, and I think that's what's amazing. That's why I love talking to writers and artists and people who do what we do, because there's not one who just ascended into it all.
Right.
Everyone had to buy the delusion until it wasn't a delusion anymore.
So you were just saying that the person that you feel like said you can't do it is the universe. For all those shows, you know, it's like, I remember playing in Asbury Park and going and playing, and there was no one at that show.
When you tell people that story, because I do, they're like, oh, but Smith's Paul crowd. I'm like, you don't understand.
Nobody.
No one. And you're like loudly playing while the promoter like looks at you. And it's like, this sucks. You suck. Yeah.
You drove 6 hours or 10 hours in a van with people that sometimes you really didn't even like.
Yeah.
To do it, just
you hurt
to
your
do
body,
it.
You hurt your mind, you just like diminished the no money you had. It's those early days of touring are so formative. I talk about this all the time. I don't know if people realize this. I'll be like at a show, it'll be sold out, and I'll have this feeling like, I hope they come. Because I can't take it if they don't come. Like,
still.
Do you ever have like a cousin come visit you in Iowa who's like, Ross is in a band, we're gonna go see the band, and they show up and like, this is what you've been doing? Like, there's no one here.
Yeah, I had a cousin come up to my show in Seattle, and they were all they were really supportive. But I mean, I want to go back to one thing that you said, which was that you had to ask your parents for money. And this was something, there's an artist, Andy Grammer, he's said to me before, he's like, I think that there's always going to be an asterisk next to my success because I'm a white male and just so much is given to a white male. And, you know, when I think of being in a place where you can ask your parents for some money, my parents helped me out a couple years after college and doing the same sort of thing. You know, I'm so thankful to have been part of that. But one of my questions is like, and I've wondered this, if my parents weren't able to help me out, I don't know how I would have gotten here. Because there were so many times where, you know, I was, that assistance kept me afloat.
Oh,
I mean, they weren't giving, I was eating pasta with butter and salt because like,
but you weren't
I
not
made
eating.
It go, but I wasn't not eating.
Everyone needs help.
So like,
that's a real thing.
I've always wondered like, how do you make it in this, how does somebody make it in this industry if they can't ask for help?
That's tough. I mean, you need to find people who believe in you. I don't think it necessarily has to be the place you were raised from. You know, I think there's, but that's a huge problem with our government and our society. We know other countries have ways that if you're an artist, you can find help, you can get a grant, you can seek it out in another way. We're not really set up to take care of people who aren't in, I mean, in so many ways, obviously that's incredibly obvious. But there's a huge hole. That's something the music business, you know, some of us get involved in music education and things like that. Like everyone needs to be picked up in some way. There's a huge hole there.
When in the process, you know, Steel Train had a following. That was like, that's like a real band.
It got there. It took a long time. So like we worked 10 years to get to the point where we could like, I think at the height, not to put it in financial terms, but we each made $300 a week. That was how, and that was enough to sustain on tour, not borrow money, go home, live with our parents. Like, no one moved out of their houses. That was enough that, and that was, we were the richest men on earth.
Right.
And in reality, that wasn't delusion. We had a van, a trailer, and we could drive around the country and not lose money.
Yeah.
And feed ourselves.
It's
a fucking miracle if you think about it.
Yeah, for sure. And there's also, there's a difference between happiness and joy and some of these other adjectives that describe that. But in the English language, there's only like the word, for the most part, when you would describe that time, you think of it as like, it's the same thing as I was saying, like you're only so successful. Like the word successful is arbitrary.
It's an absurdly relative concept.
Totally. Same with happiness. And when you're saying in this case that like you're able to provide for yourself and be a musician and you're able to tour around in a van and whatnot, like that's as happy as you get, in a sense that there were times where, you know, we'd run into each other on your like eighth month of touring for the biggest song in the world. And I don't know if you're happier at that time than you are when you have $300 a week. I think no.
It's just different. They're just different universes.
Yeah.
So you're always in some sort of spectrum where the you know, when I was in Steel Train, the bottom of the spectrum was not get by and no one comes and it's horrible. And the top of the spectrum was I looked at bands that could draw 500 to 1,000 people, and I said that is the top. That is the ultimate goal here. And now that's shifted. That's shifted as life goes on. Then you have another experience. It's no different than like girls. It's like you make out with a girl and you're like, holy shit, what if I could touch her boobs one day? Cut to like you're in your 20s and you're fucking and you're like seeing some weird shit on porn. Maybe, I don't know. But like your whole spectrum shifts. You know?
Yeah.
You remember that like being in like sixth grade and you're like, you had second base? And second base was like the equivalent of like, oh, like I'm, you know,
yeah, I was
not even entering the Hot 100. You know, to like you're in 12th grade and you're like, it was number one for a week. That sucks. Like,
so everything. Yeah, I was a chubby Harry Potter. I wasn't having that conversation in sixth grade. I was wearing like a silk shirt with like different colors on it. It's like mid 1990s.
So maybe
at
you were
best.
Just trying to, you know, even get a base hit.
Yeah, man.
You know, maybe you were trying to bunt, yeah. Like a successful bunt.
Yeah, totally. When,
but I think about that a lot, like how weird it's gotten where, but you know this comedian, Mike Birbiglia?
Yeah.
He's a great comedian. He's a really old friend of mine. I've known him for a long, long, long time. Met him at Bonnaroo 2005. He said this thing to me because he's had an amazing career that just keeps growing and growing. And he goes, I keep feeling like every time I achieve something, someone's going to like grab me and like take me in through a trap door and be like, now you're in. Or like, here's your card. This is how we would do it. This is how you do it when you have a number one record. This is what happens when you win a Grammy, all this stuff, right? And he said, all this stuff, you work and you work and you work and you achieve this new level and you think something's going to happen and you just, the bubble bursts and you're like, oh, it's just about the work.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's just about the songs. It's just about how good the records are and the performance. And then all this stuff and there's all this hype and you have this moment and poof, oh, there was nothing at the end of that tunnel. It's just about what happens when you write.
It's weird. You almost have to experience the mountaintop a couple times, you know, to recognize that it's not a tangible thing. You know, even people who climb Mount Everest, it's cool. You get there, but you still have to quickly turn around, or you die on the way down.
Yeah.
I mean, like you can only be there for a minute, and then you have to turn around, and you have to turn around quickly. And you have to like move like your way back down. And then when you get down to the bottom, you can go and start training for like the next year
That's
again.
Exciting. Training
yeah.
for it is.
But I think the idea is like you get up to the top and there's going to be a parade or even that parade. Like I imagine
that's not very long either.
It's not very long either.
And also really it's not very satisfying.
Yeah.
You realize that, that's what I believe about writing and making work is that feeling compelled to do it. Like even right now, like I'm like, what is that? I'm gonna go to the studio today. It's like, am I gonna find that thing? Is anything gonna happen? Is it gonna be another day of almost, or is something actually gonna happen? And then when something happens, you get so excited and you feel so alive. But I think just existing in that process is the highest form of consciousness I've found.
Do you know when you write a great song?
I know when I have a moment. I know when I have, I don't write a ton. So I don't have a lot of, I know when something feels exciting to me. Which more and more I'm starting to give myself permission to say, well, if something feels exciting to me, then it's a real thing. I'm trying to let go of what, you know, the mill of, is it going to work? Is this, is that, you know, the anatomy of something that quote unquote works is really just something we like.
Right. I mean, we talked about this a little bit when we did the Songwriter Hall of Fame thing last year, but your technique is so different. Your math and your arrangements are just different than, you know, let's say the Swedes. Is that intentional?
It's become, no. Max always calls me in, what does he call me, an unprofessional songwriter? In a sweet way.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like one time Max told me why, like, he was comparing We Are Young and I Want to Get Better and saying why both of them were incorrect. I didn't know that, but now I take pride in the niche. Now yeah. I'm happy to be that if that's the hole I fall into, I'm cool with it. I never did well with it. Like it when I find a song or an idea that is exciting to me, it's because it's exciting to me, not because of any other thing. And I've never worked well with people that stitch things together that way. But I have so much respect for it. It's like I just don't have. I'm not great. I'm not good there.
Yeah. Does it make you second guess yourself?
No. That's the one nice thing about any kind of success is I feel a little
confident.
A little more confident in things that I was always secretly confident in.
Yeah.
Because I think that we've all have that part of us. Like you wouldn't write songs if there wasn't this tiny little voice that was like, I really think there's something here. Once again, no one starts this to make money. And the fallacy of starting it to like get girls or guys or whatever is not really, like you do it because you have to do it. And you really believe that there's, you know, I think that's why so many songwriters have so much self-hatred, because you started this because you actually think that these songs that you are capable of writing are something the world should hear. That's a very tough thing to come to terms with. There's a lot of ego there.
With the ego attached to songs, you know, especially when we're talking about the mountaintop and then songs kind of go away, if that's the metaphor, mm-hmm. You know, I guess one of the themes that we've had in recent interviews have basically been that legacy is stupid. You know, it's that in a way it's like, you know, it's not like...
Does legacy exist in the modern world though, with the amount of information that happens?
I mean...
Aren't we just sort of focused on moments at this point?
If we were to ask people who are listening to this to sing me a melody... That was written by Mozart. Sing me a melody that was written by Beethoven. Sing me a melody that was written by, you know, Paul McCartney. Let alone Miles Davis or Franz Liszt or like, you know, going backwards or Bach or something like that. My assumption is that even some of the most astute listeners that we have can't really do all that.
Yeah. Having a moment where I was like,
not to belittle that. I'm just saying that like legacy has been stupid for a long time. It just took me getting older and realizing that you know, I don't know what the purpose is of any of it. I think in a way, like the purpose of it is to make people feel in the moment really excited. But like the idea of people talking about my success in the future is weird. I mean, you know, you could very well end up being some sort of Confederate monument and somebody, you know, you think you're achieving some sort of thing and but you're, you know, eventually they just take you down like, or nobody remembers who you are, so they don't mind.
Is a very funny thing to think about, just who's going to hear it, when they're going to hear it. I take a lot of comfort in knowing it exists for people to find.
The music exists.
Yeah, I don't take comfort in being like, oh, people are going to listen to this forever, and I'll live forever through that. I take comfort in knowing that this, like, you know, it's like a diamond. You know, when they sift through diamonds,
yeah,
and like those like big strainers, and
yeah,
like it's there, and if someone ever wants to find it, they can. So,
yeah.
You know, short of like the entire universe being erased, it does make me feel a little less freaked out about dying.
Are you freaked out about dying?
Not like any more than anyone, but it's there. I mean, I do think about my work as like, I back it up towards not being here anymore. Like there's certain things I want to do, certain songs I want to write. If I get an idea, like we were talking earlier about this song, about how a person wouldn't talk to themselves the way they would talk to a friend, like that gives me stress if I actually have an idea and I want to write it and I haven't done it yet.
Yeah. I mean, that's what makes you motivated as a writer. Like, I crave those moments because that means that I have a purpose to go and actually write, not just like... I think I've written songs and crafted through not being inspired, but those moments where you're actually inspired to write down that concept, that's exciting.
It's very exciting. You know? But it's all crazy. It's fucking nuts. If you think about it, I think you could drive yourself crazy. What if I didn't go to the studio that day? What if I didn't drop my phone on the piano key that hit that note that led me to like just have that melody? Like, it's just, there's no rhyme or reason. It's
have you
so
had
tiring.
A moment where you were like, I don't really want to go to the studio, and then you Tons. Went and it was like, oh my God, that's...
Endless moments where I go to the studio and someone doesn't show up, and then I'm left in a room with someone else and we just kind of noodle around and it leads to something crazy, or anything good I've ever done. Like,
any examples for those?
Tons. I mean, when I did the track for Out of the Woods, which is a Taylor song that I'm really proud of, there was some issue at a venue and our show was canceled that night and I didn't have my stuff. I had left it on the bus, so I only had these old samples on what was on my laptop and cut up that OO thing, and I only had like this one drum kit on there, and I like it just all dumb little things. When I made it, I Want to Get Better, I was in Malaysia and my... MPC software literally glitched out and just started going like da 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 da. It was like, and I was like, and I kind of like started bobbing my head to it. Like, it's always something incredibly stupid.
It puts in perspective how much
powerless.
Yeah, just powerless. Right?
I always think that literally every song. I mean, when I was doing Fun and we did Some Nights, we sort of like had this weird college show in Phoenix and someone was like, if you want to use one of the music rooms, we went to the music room, started like banging out the song. Like, it's always some dumb thing where if that one college student wasn't like, hey, do you want to use our piano room? What the fuck? Would that have not happened? Would then We Are Young have been a one-hit wonder and we wouldn't have had a follow-up that wouldn't matter? And then would I not have been able to done it? It could drive you fucking insane and paralyze you, because what are you supposed to do? How are you supposed to create those moments? You can't.
Speaking of going back to the legacy thing, what you should do, or what we should do, is find out which exact room it was he wrote Some Nights, send a plaque so they could put it on their wall, because imagine every student walking into that room being like, holy shit, this is the room.
Yeah, and then what, some student's gonna see that and then be like, think they want to write the opposite of that song, and then that leads to something. It's just sure. Everything is so wildly connected. But everything I've done that I've been proud of, something silly happened. I don't know. Have you really had the like, let's go in and write this song, and you actually write that song?
No.
Isn't it always never. Like a weird cousin of that song?
Absolutely.
That meets like another weird cousin. They have like an incestual relationship, and they birth like the right song.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, it's amazing how many voice notes I have where you hear the crinkling of plastic because I'm picking up my dog's shit while I'm singing. Into my phone with my other hand and holding his leash, you know, while I'm like trying to sing this melody into my phone.
Yeah, that shit crinkle sound leads to a drum sound, probably.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when you're in a band in LA, there's so many bands in LA where they've spent 10 years in a band and they don't quit. They're just like, yo, we're going to make it someday. And I worry about those people because they're so loyal to each other that they're willing to not move on when they know something is broken. And they think that somehow they're going to either write the hit or someone's going to now discover them. And I tend to think that there's some expiration on certain projects. And you've been in a few bands that have all been successful on different levels. And there have been some time where you said, you know, that you were done with Steel Train, that you're done with Fun, and now you're in Bleachers. When do you know when to sort of end a project to start a new one? And how do you facilitate that political nature in bands?
Politics aside, I think your body tells you. So I think your body is like when your body just starts focusing on things. So like when I started Bleachers while I was in Fun, on these like big arena tour, theoretically everything should have been like really great, and I just would, without thinking about it, just like found myself going back to the hotel and writing songs every night. And I always wrote songs, but you know the difference between writing songs and writing a project. You could write a million, billion songs, but writing an album is a totally different experience. You know, like it's like, and I was like, oh my God, I'm making an album. My body did it before I admitted to myself. Before I could deal with how the fuck am I going to be in fun and have another album? What are people going to think? I don't want to have a side project. That's not me. Like, I don't want to be like some guy in a band who looks like he's grabbing that success and starts. Like, before I could even deal with all that shit, I was just making an album. So I think your body really, it's no different than like relationships. Like I really believe in like following just like, what do you do? What are you writing? Like your life right now, like what are you writing? Sure, you're not a total hippie fuck off. You're not like not showing up to sessions and like digging a hole in your backyard looking for a song. But like in between life, what are you doing? What is just like naturally happening? Is your eye twitching? Are you writing your polka project? Like so that's A. I've always just sort of followed, you know, even at the end of Steel Train, I got really excited about fun. And I was like, kind of want to be here. But politically it is weird. And fun had a totally weird thing, you know, where but that was a weird one because me, Andrew, and Nate had all worked so hard for so long. Nate was in the format, I was a Steel Train, Andrew was in Onathala. You're not talking about people who did 2 years of weird touring. You know, we were 26, 27 when that thing took off. You're talking 10 years in for all of us of like building and building and building. And so it happened and it happened quickly. It was weird. Everyone had a different reaction. And also songwriting became a part of that. We all started doing things with other people. That was also, to get back to the chip, that was motivating for me because when I was in fun, I had written songs for so long and had my own bands and then done everything else. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, I'm the guitar player in this band with the glasses or whatever. I'm this caricature that is, and it didn't make me mad at people because I was like, I see that. I think about my favorite bands. Oh, there's that dude. I recognize his face. He can't be doing anything because he's not singing it. And I noticed that. I won't use any names, but, and this sort of segues how I really got into writing. I always wanted to collaborate, and I always wanted to do things. And I was trying to figure out a publishing deal because We Are Young and Become a Hit. And so all of a sudden, I'm sure you had this moment where you go from, I want to do this, to everyone's like, well, now you can. Like, we're opening the door because we finally trust you. Doesn't make me mad, but it's just how it is. You know, I'm that way. My manager will call me and say, do you want to work with someone? And I'll be like, well, who are they? And if my manager says, they're just this person, I'll be like, okay, I'll look it up. But if he's like, oh, they did this song that you love, I'll be like, oh, great. It's just, it's knowing someone or not. So when We Were Young happened, I had a shot. And I remember this really motivated me. So this person who wanted to sign all of us, he started setting up sessions. And he set Nate, who was a singer in Fun Up, he set him up with Bruno Mars and Pink. And he set me up with two people that I don't even know if write songs anymore. And I remember I had this moment. I don't have a lot of advice because I'm not super old yet or super accomplished, but I always tell people in that moment, I was like, I gotta find my people.
Who see you as the front man of your life?
And by the way, it's not about front and center because half my days are spent just
it's not
helping
the ego part. It's
other right. artists yeah. work on their vision. It's not about that. It's just, I was like, damn, I gotta find my people. And I worked on it and I slowly did, but that was also part of that chip of like, I wanted to define myself outside of that because, it felt odd to be in an ecosystem where I was very like, was having all this success, but I felt like I couldn't do the things I wanted to do.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You really have to find your people. And that ecosystem at the time with a lot of the people we were working with on the business side, I was kind of like, hi, like I have this idea for another band. I want to write songs too. And everyone was like, yeah, we'll get to you. Just, you know, play the guitar and rock out on the stage. And I'll be like, but I'm not delusional because I've been doing this for 10 years before all this shit happened, before radio, before number one songs. I got all these songs. And so that's a big thing that I've taken with me is don't, you know, you don't want to have blinders. Look around, like, because there might be some dude or some girl to the left who you don't think is the one that's going to have the heart and the songs, and they might actually got it. So that was also part of that chip that we were talking about of like, oh, I gotta, you know, not just get defined by this.
The single to my, I was in a band called Glacier Hiking, and the single for Glacier Hiking was a song called Stay Positive, which I took from the musical I'm recording right now. So in like 2009, the song was from this musical. And I remember saying to my bandmate and to, you know, the producer, I was like, well, let me play you the musical. And they're like, nah, it's fine. Like,
yeah.
We get that you have a musical. You're like, no, I swear it's like a really modern, like cool thing. And then, Stay in your lane. And that song ended up becoming, you know, the song that we really were pushing for whatever moment we were pushing it. And, you know, it's 8 years later right now and I'm recording that musical for real and we're, you know, all this stuff's really happening with it. And it's shocking just to see that this piece of music, you know, I was waving it to them. I was like, no, I'm telling you guys, no, this is real. And people are really liking it. Like when I play for other people, they really enjoy this. And
they were like,
not into it. They're just, you know. It's cool, man.
Good luck
with that. And you're like,
I have so many songs that have become massive hit songs that I waved in someone else's face before they had a reason. I mean, dude, stories, endless stories of, oh, Jack can't do that. Oh, Jack's not a writer. Oh, he is. Okay, well, Jack's not a producer. He's never produced a hit. Then you produce a hit. It's like, I've been waving things in people's faces and it used to piss me off. Now it doesn't. You just got to prove it. Because one thing it does do is it makes me recognize excitement. If I'm in a room with someone and they're like, I got this other thing, I'm like, please tell me about it. Because it's that same feeling when you're in a room with people and you're like, but there's also this. And they're like, nah, do the guitar part. You know, it's always something. For a while it was, do the guitar part. And then it was, okay, he can write. All right, do the top line. And it's like, but I think I can also produce. And everyone's like, no. And then you get there and you always got to prove it. You always got to go take it.
Yeah.
And I think is a nice thing to remember.
Well, you produce music now that feels, it feels like you're not really you're not very good at chasing trends.
I'm not good at it.
You're really not. I mean, in the nicest way. Like you have all these like you can have the most current pop stars writing with you, but there's something about your productions that feel. They're much more timeless. They're much more like songs that, in a way, we grew up with. Even if there's modern synths and stuff like that, there's not like...
If it came across my desk, it's over. If I know it's a trend, it's cooked because I'm not out there. You know, there was a time when I was 16, I was like on the street at the Legion Hall in New Jersey witnessing shit. You know, we're like 18 in New York City when like the Mercury Lounge was happening. Like, but at 33... If you're telling me that trap's happening, it fucking happened already. You know, like, so I've just sort of resigned to this thing of like, I just want, I think the best way that I can contribute to the world is just what I think is cool because I'm not interested in, I don't know, if we find out about it, it's over.
Right.
I want to incriminate you. If I find
No, you're right. I mean, like, I went,
And why would you want to also?
Right.
It's like, I also feel that way. That was a big lesson too from the way I came up of like, you know,
tempting though.
It's tempting because it'll research quote unquote better.
Right.
But I think it's also once again the chip. When We Are Young happened and I started going into rooms, there was so much energy to recreate that. And I was just like, but that worked because it didn't sound like anything. No one, when that song was in the hands of the label, so that was my first hit, right? It didn't sound like anything. And no one earmarked it as a single. The only reason why that song became a single is because Jeff Basker, who produced that song, played the song for Kanye. Kanye took the song, him and Jay-Z rapped on it, kept the hook, put it on Watch the Throne, and then took it off Watch the Throne 2 weeks before. But during that time period, all of a sudden, everyone working on Fun was like, whoa. We thought we were signing this little indie band and we're going to make a cheap album. What the hell are these huge stars doing recording this album? We got something here. You know how that works in the industry. And then something gets earmarked as the next thing. But it wasn't because that song was like, no one was like, that's going to be a massive, massive hit. Everything I've ever had, the next thing I did was Brave with Sarah Bareilles. We just like noodled around and did that. And I sent it to my manager and I think he was the one who was like, this is like actually really good. But it didn't really sound, it was sort of like this like poppy piano anthem. And I've never had an experience. Once again, I'll just talk about my own inadequacy. I'm just not good at recreating stuff, but I also don't respond to it as a person because I think people can tell.
Right.
And I'd rather have a song that shits out at 20 or 50 or whatever than one that goes further but doesn't. You know, it's a game I like to play. Think about your favorite songs from the 90s. Check out their chart position. Blow your fucking mind.
Yeah. It is
all crazy. The ones that are the number one songs in my head are really like number 65, but it's like the actual number one song that year, gone.
Yeah.
But that other song, but that's what I'm chasing. I'm chasing the big songs that are actually the good, the ones.
Copyrights.
That hang out.
Evergreens.
Evergreens.
Yeah. Do you think that, I mean, you now have a number of hits. What do you think are the evergreens? Do you think you, I mean, I feel like you kind of have a few, but in your head, what do you think in 15 years, if it's fortunate enough, what are the songs that people are going to say like, man, that's an evergreen?
I don't know. I mean, there's the ones to me.
Which ones are to you?
I think one of the biggest evergreens, for putting it, is the Lord song, Greenlight.
Yeah.
That song means so much to me. I think it's like, I still don't get sick of it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like a crazy radio hit. But people like it so much. I don't know, I think Out of the Woods, the Taylor song, is like that. I think that I just look for those songs that actually kind of stick with people. You know, even just like sort of just like field research, you know, not like M scores or if someone clicks off the radio here or there or whatever, but like people come up to me on the street, they're like, I love that song. I want to get better, it seems, at that feeling where it just feels like I just like shouted enough of my life. And even like, like some nights, like, no, I don't meet too many people who are like, oh God, if I hear that one again, like people seem to like it.
Yeah.
Which is essentially, because that's a funny thing about our business, right? The ability to have success and annoy people.
Yeah. Dude, I mean,
I don't want that, but it's so present in our business.
Sure.
And I believe that, because here's how I feel about the radio. I don't think it's going anywhere. And my whole fucking life, everyone's like, the radio's going away. And they just keep being wrong. And I think streaming is a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it's the fucking 80s again in the music business. You see it. Budgets are opening up. We're entering a new golden era. It's wonderful. We're no longer on this Hindenburg. Great. However, 30, 40 million songs. Fantastic. You, me, kids in Sri Lanka, someone in Dallas, Texas, we need to be connected somehow. We're connected by Trump. We hate him. We're connected by Game of Thrones because we love it. And then we're connected by a certain list of songs. Maybe this song we're connected by because if we fucking hear it one more time, we're going to rip our eyes out. Yeah. And maybe this song we're connected by because we love it. But we can't live, and I am full left corner of the sandbox type motherfucker usually, but even when I was like going to punk shows and Legion Halls, my existence was railing against goddamn Britney Spears and NSYNC. So that thing, it's sort of like Sprite, image nothing, thirst is everything. Well, that's your image. It's like whether you are a vessel that rails against the mainstream in that 10-song radio playlist, or you love it and it's Michael Jackson and the world is new again, or it's Taylor, Drake, Kanye, Beyonce, Adele, it's good music, or it's utter garbage that makes you want to kill yourself, we have to fucking be connected by it. It can't go away. And so I always say that when I'm in label meetings, like, where are the gatekeepers? Is that going to be good or is it going to be bad?
Yeah, how will people remember? And back to legacy, but how will people remember this period?
That's the I love trying to freak out like A&R guys. That's the new thing I say. I say, when you're dead.
Yeah, right.
I like to start conversations with, when you're dead, if like I'm in there and I got a special song and I'm like, I'd like you to really work on this. Not because I need to make more money, not because I need to be more well-known, but because in that short playlist that you have the keys to, I think this one, this song about loss or real friendship or
right.
whatever it is, I think this one has the power to kind of matter a little bit more. And then I say, when you're dead,
right?
You know, are they going to remember for this or that? I like right. to plant that seed.
In both the Lord album and in both Bleacher albums, the lyrics are certainly in the verses really small and close. And when you're talking about uniting a lot of people, it's really interesting because I feel like they're so personal. And do you think that helps getting an audience to become...
I think it's helped
closer because they then end up feeling like more connected. Because like if you get Jack, then like, and I get Jack, then we're close. Or is that a detriment? You know,
I think it's probably both. But I think that, I mean, that's why I love the mainstream so much, is not because, and this is arguments I've had with writers a lot, not because I think it's stupid, but because when it's smart, God, it's amazing, right? When it's Obama, it's the best feeling. but okay, you're a freak. You're a total freak, right? You're like working on your musical and
yeah, right.
You do this show because you're a total freak of nature. Like you're not representative, and I hope you take this as a compliment. I know you, of like your average person hanging out on Instagram. You're not like, it's weird that you are penning things that everyone knows.
Right.
But that's what's like so exciting is to say like, okay, if I'm this piece of shit over here, if anything, what do I have in common with everyone? That's the chorus to me. What do I have in common with everyone? Doesn't have to be the whole song, because I'm not writing a jingle for everyone. So it's like, whether it's me or other artists, I say, you got the whole verse. You can say whatever the fuck you want. You could talk about when masturbation loss is fun, you're fucking lazy Green Day. You could talk about... propaganda. Did you know I was 9 and tried to fuck a friend of mine? He was 8. I turned 10. 14 years later, it happened again. You can say whatever you want. Bruce Springsteen, I want to change my clothes, my hair, my face. A writer came in and was like, I have a great line. I want to change my clothes,
right.
my hair, my face. I'd be like, well, that's going to be a really hard song. Cut to, even if we're just dancing in the dark. It's like,
yeah.
that the chorus, hook, it's not a bad word, literally fucking grabs you by the mouth and you're along for the ride. And then that ride... one song is an entire life. So whether it's me, that you know, I want to get better. I'm talking about losing my mind from taking acid, the death of my sister, panic and anxiety disorder. But hey, I want to get better. and so I said, when I wrote that song, I was like, I think I can squeeze this by people because everyone wants to get better. Taylor Out of the Woods talking about all this very personal stuff about a relationship falling apart, liking it to this snowmobile accident, going to the hospital and seeing all the darkness and color in a relationship. But are we out of the woods? I if you ask me, are we out of the woods yet? If my Uber driver turned around and just said, are we out of the woods yet? I would say, I would immediately know what he was talking about in my life.
Right.
Every song that I've ever, Sarah with Brave is a very personal story about a friend coming out, but I want to see you be brave. If you looked me in the eye and said that to me right now, no matter what the fuck, if anyone said it to me, if fucking Trump said that to me, it might matter. And so I think that's the ultimate goal. God, how easy would it be to write songs that fly over people's head?
Yeah.
I could do that right now. And then I could just sit in my corner and be like, you don't get it. But when you've had that connection with people, it's incredible. But I think I always say that versus go to town.
It's the difference on some level of either being the artist or writing with the artist versus pitching songs too. Like I feel like when you're pitching a song, you have to be aware of the fact that...
Do you pitch a lot?
Of the songs that... Same with Love, My House, and Dangerous Woman were all pitched.
Dangerous Woman seems so personal, though.
I mean, if you hear me playing it on acoustic guitar, it sounds like...
That just may be lightning in a bottle, because that seems like, as an outsider and a fan,
yeah,
that seems like the thing I had been waiting for her to say.
Yeah.
Like, actually knew...
But when I was, I thought it was for...
Did you talk to her before?
I thought it was for Carrie Underwood first. Okay. Well, I've talked to Carrie about it now. So we're friends. It's cool. But like, I always thought she would be right for it. But I went to Nashville and I didn't know anybody who knew Carrie. And I had this like chorus written out. And then I went back home and I played it for Johan and we did a version of it. And when we were done, we were like... You know, Alicia Keys was coming in the next day. So we were like, oh, maybe this is more for like Alicia or something like that. And we played it for my publisher, who then was like, you know what? Let's get a girl vocal on it because that's going to help. And
was it you singing?
Yeah.
So you were singing You Make Me Feel Like a Dangerous Woman?
Well, that's part of the craziness of that. I just thought it was a really cool concept. Yeah. And I thought it was a really dark melody over like those chords, which felt really empowering. Like to me, it felt like it was like almost like a blues, more of a blues record at first.
Well, you know what grabbed me about it, and I don't know if you intended this in any way. You know the song "Natural Woman," is that kind
yes.
of thing. So it doesn't sound anything like that in any way, but obviously, you know, the woman, dangerous woman, natural yeah. woman. I thought it sounded like you could hear society had like melting away over 40 years since that song came out of like, you make me feel like a natural woman, like you feel like a dangerous woman. It felt like oddly like this like political time yeah. capsule.
Well, it's weird you say that because the original version of it before, because I have all the voice memos and the first voice memo I have of it is me driving and being like, ah, oh, this would be cool if there was some sort of modern version of that. And it was like, you know, like something about you makes me want to be that kind of woman. That was like the very first version. And it was like, well, that kind of sucks. And like, how
always,
do you like edit that, into something?
Words like that, this. Yeah, it's like, well, what?
Right.
That's the only, I don't want to.
I would do anything for
like,
love,
like that,
but
the
Chainsmokers
song. Like, I want something yeah. just like this.
Yeah.
I always, no shade on anyone, but whenever I hear that song in my head, I go, just like what? Tell me.
But that's
but
the
like,
thing. Okay.
But I want to know. Like if you said like, I want something just like I want love just like pain. I want pain just like
love.
Food. Like I want like, you know, like just like tell me because I'm listening to your song and I got to listen to it every day at the airport and the Uber and the blah, blah, blah. I got to hear it everywhere. So just tell me what you want. Please.
But that's
it's like being
a difference
in a, it's like being in a bad relationship. It's like, it's like when you're with someone that you can't. That's when the fucking radio drives me crazy. It's like, communicate with me. I don't have to love your production. I don't have to love your drum sounds. But fucking tell me something. That's why I love that Dangerous Woman song. When I would hear it, it'd be like, I understand exactly what you're saying.
Right.
Thank you. And now I can choose if I want to stream that song 100 million times or never listening to it. But songs, and maybe I'm overthinking this, songs like I want something just like this. I'm like, you've got to tell me how you feel.
Yeah.
Or else I can't. Go on.
But that's the difference of a lot of the sessions are...
You didn't write that song, did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay, good.
But a lot of the... if I did, that'd be great.
That'd be amazing. But I also, I knew you didn't because you're... I knew you
right.
wouldn't say that.
But there are a lot of co-writers I have are immigrants. And so they speak, they want to write songs that communicate, not that there were immigrants on that particular song, but they want to speak to the world. And a lot of that world doesn't speak English.
Yeah.
And so they like the sound of the word and they like the broad strokes vibes.
But sometimes you get the most emotion out of that. Sometimes because I work with a lot of people that are not from here too.
Yeah.
Or English as a second language. And sometimes they just, a person who has less words will just say it in a way where you're like, whoa. It's the same reason why I write on piano and not guitar. I'm better at guitar. So I'm like, oh, these are dumb chords. You know, I'm on piano. I'm just like, that's beautiful. You know, so sometimes yeah. when I'm writing with someone who has English as a second language, they'll just be like they'll be like, I want love. And you're like, ah, that's gorgeous.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's an Elton John song, but right. I fuck with that all the time.
Just a comment. One of the things that I really like about, you know, the you were able to release both the Lord album and the Bleachers album, I believe, the same week.
Yeah, like 2 weeks apart.
2 weeks apart.
Which is totally unintentional. I cannot believe it worked out that way.
So awesome. And one of the things that's really cool about it is that you guys both wrote on each other's albums.
Yeah. Well, there was a full...
I think that's really cool. Well, even though I think she only wrote on one song, but I think like...
But she was like so, I mean...
How cool is that though? That
she was very helpful with just opinions.
Yeah.
Because you know when you get... Sometimes you're like I'm in a phase right now where I'm just like free and I'm trying things and I'm doing this, I'm finishing that, I'm just noodling around. But then when I was making the Lord album and the Bleachers album, that was like 18 months of like, this is the only thing I'm doing. And it's every day. Is chipping, you know how it is. Sometimes you write these songs or work with an artist or your own songs, and it's like it comes out, and you're like, put a helmet on that thing, that is done. Back up the fucking drive right now. And then sometimes you're just like chipping away at a fucking piece of stone looking for this album and the song forever. And you know it's in there. There's no question. That was the Lord and the Bleachers album. There was never a question that it was in there. It was, those were just two records that had to work like that. But I had been in the hole for so long. That when they came out, I had this feeling that of relief that it was real, literally, you know, because I had done so much. Those two albums were the only thing I was doing, and no one had heard them for so long.
Yeah.
And I'd go out and play shows, and I'd play old music. People would say, "What are you working on?" Blah blah blah. Blah. And I don't like that. I like when things come out quick.
Do you get nervous when your songs come out?
No, I get relieved, mostly relieved. I mean, I don't feel, I'd have trouble admitting this a couple of years ago. I'm trying to admit it now, which is that when a song comes out, I have an expectation for what is supposed to happen for it. And I don't mean that in a gross way. I mean that in an emotional way. I think to myself, okay, this is not the kind of song that I want to be a huge radio song. This is the kind of song that I want for people to put in their back pocket and to be a secret for 100,000 people across the world. And just, it sounds like a lot, but just, you know, or 10,000 people across the world or 5 people across the world, whatever it is. And then sometimes I write songs and I think, I really, truly want the whole world to hear this. Not because of any of the gross reasons, but I really think I did a good job.
Yeah.
And I really, and it's formatted
because
for
people
it.
Will, you, there's a certain part where when you start writing, in a way, knowing your audience and knowing humanity, and you're like, no, this would really entertain you. If you give it a shot,
yeah,
I promise you, you'll really enjoy this.
Yeah,
I'm
some
a
of these
fairly
lyrics,
good curator at these things. Like yeah. This one, you'd really have a good time.
Well, ego is for that. Ego is for you know. I had more ego when I had less going on, because I had a bigger chip. Now it's not ego. Now I'm not like, you got to hear my shit, blah blah. I'm just like no. I know this is a great one. And I hope that the powers that be open the gates, because this will be good for the community.
There's a little bit of the burden of success in that way, is that you feel like, you know, it's like your obligation to entertain people, and also like the fans tend to always feel like a certain level of success becomes selling out. So you're like having to constantly battle like, no, it's really just a song you should enjoy. Well, it's just take it for what it is and not.
Or like there's no, yeah. I don't know. I mean, I feel this way about press a lot, but I feel that, what if it's exactly what it is? And I understand why. And when you do a lot of things, I think if you're, I'm a top laner. This is what I do. Good night. It's very easy for people to be like, that person's a great top laner. I make tracks. This is what I do.
Yeah.
Bye. I put out records. I'm this person. I only write books. I only, you know, I think it's, if you're very clear, just like Trump's campaign, you know, it's like Steve Bannon's whole point. Like,
there
just
you
if you stay on narrative, you're going to get the idiots. You know, and so I think the second you start doing a lot of things, I'm sure you've seen this within the industry, people start questioning, like, why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? And I just keep trying to say, well, it's just what it is. It's just what I told you it is. I really think I can do this.
All right, I'm going to list 5 people.
Okay.
And just tell me what comes off the top of your head.
Okay.
All right. Rachel Antonoff.
My biggest inspiration. The ultimate hit. Predictor. Truly.
Really?
Oh, she... There's two... My sister and my girlfriend are the two people that I care most about their opinion about music. They're like babies. They don't care. All of us in this room,
yeah.
It's like, when you play me a song, it's like, I'm going to tell you who I am in my 14-word reaction to this song. You know, it's like, well, I mean, the drums are a little dated, but yeah, it's a good melody. It's like, you know, like, my girlfriend and my sister, they're just like, they like it or they fucking don't.
So funny.
Babies.
I sent a song to an artist last week, and I told my wife about it, and she goes, "Let me guess, he didn't like it, right?" And I was like, "Well, he hasn't responded." She goes, "Babe, this song's just not very good." You know, like she was trying to get me not to send it. I was like, "I kind of like it," and she's like, "I'm telling you." And she's the same thing.
She has no skin in the game.
Yeah,
she just likes it or she doesn't.
Yeah,
and it's a beautiful reaction.
So funny. Nate Roos,
we had our break together.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, never. That was one thing Lior Cohen said to me when We Are Young was happening. And he's a very intimidating person. He's very tall. He looked at me and he said, "This will never happen again." I was like, "What do you mean?" And he was like, "Not success." He's like, "I'm sure you're gonna have a great career, but you never get a break again."
Right.
And so there's memories me, Nate, and Andrew shared that I'll never. We flew first class for the first time, and got drunk and shouted "New Money." like you just were idiots, you know. We're idiots. We were on, you know, we heard our shit on the radio for the first time. You can't go back to that.
Lord.
I think Ella is. She's our Bjork. She's our Kate Bush. She's the future. Not because she's young, because she doesn't seem young. Her age is just like this, like, weird detail. Ella's age is like if, like, right now you were like, "Check this out," and took your shirt off, and you had like a Primus backplate tattoo, and I'd be like, "What?" Like, I'm always like, "You're 20," like, but you're teaching me so much. Deeply important artist, and from a very selfish point of view, it just believes in me in a very serious way. And I'm sure you have people like this in your life. Maybe for good family relationships or whatever, the best comes out of me when someone actually believes in me.
Mm-hmm.
She pushed me a lot for her own record, which is funny because probably should have been vice versa.
Lena Dunham.
As I said before, the other true, clear-headed song, the person who can really understand music. But an insane inspiration, I think, that when we got together is when I started to realize, I was like, "Oh, I can really set some pretty crazy goals." She doesn't have any, there's no door or wall between her and an idea.
Are you guys going to do projects together?
I don't know. It's funny because I've never really wanted to. What I love more than anything is lying in bed with her. She's writing, I'm listening to mixes. And I feel like a lot of art is coming from this tiny space. You know, that's, people have different ways. A lot of people are like, "How do you guys do it? It's like you're always traveling, you're ever together." And it's like, to be supported in art like that is an expression of love that's pretty absurd.
Priceless.
Yeah.
What's next for you?
Specifically or like...
Sure. I don't know. It's just a question.
What are you working on?
Is it a real question?
Yeah. What are you excited about?
Oh, man.
So you're excited about your theater.
Yeah, I think the Raw Man.
Or your play, not your theater.
For me, it's like, well, it is what it is. I don't know what, you know, when I was 18, 17, I went to this thing at Northwestern. I remember them saying, "What's a play?" And everyone's like, "Oh, well, I know what a play is." And then it's impossible to answer. I don't know. It's when people go on stage and read lines. Well, what if it's, you know, what if it's, there are no lines?
Yeah.
Is a musical a play? Is the theater of politics a play? What is it, if it's improvised, is it a play? Does it have to be, you know, does it need people for it to be a play? You know, can you just do it from lights and tell a story from something else? Idea that there is no real answer to that. And for me, The Wrong Man, it's like, it's a concept album that can be a feature length, that can be a musical, that can be a few things. And I hope people really enjoy it. But there's no, what I struggled with when I got my first record deal was that there were aisles and stores. And I don't think I fit very well in an aisle. You know, iTunes was brand new. And they
Was your music called then? Was it alternative? Like, just what aisle did you get pushed into?
I was under alternative.
Alternative is a hilarious genre because it's literally like they're like, okay.
Totally. And I was, you know, I was opening for Jurassic 5 a couple times, like more like for like a few weeks kind of thing. And I remember playing with like, you know, random bands like Ozo Motley and stuff like that. And then they put me
Just sort of left of center. Like music that people just like music.
Maybe
bands that have a random trumpet player or like.
Sure. And now
just music.
Now it has a better shot because it was not a, it's just not a genre.
Yeah. Do you feel like we're genreless now?
I think we're close. We're getting closer to it every day. I think on one level, people listen to music very differently now. They literally listen differently. They listen with headphones. Yeah, so,
which I love.
Which is it's a different way to experience music. And in mass, we're listening to music differently because people aren't driving as much. There's a whole generation of people who aren't driving as much.
And even if you drive, you don't drive. And if I'm even in a car, I'm usually in headphones in a car.
Yeah, it's... So if you're listening to music differently, then you should record it differently on some level. You should write it differently on some level, in my opinion.
Well, of course. I mean, that's mono versus stereo. There's a reason for that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure at the time there was like, you know, your Phil Spector mono purists are like, this is absurd.
Right. And I'm trying to figure out what the balance is as far as, you know, I like what I'm doing in my career with The Wrong Man. That's super exciting because I think that's different. And I like the idea that I walk into a room and try to facilitate my co-writer's best song, whether it's an art, you know, I like walking into a room and being like, what kind of song do you need? And let's write the best song you have.
Are you in a place where you're enjoying artists more or just writing more without artists?
They're just different processes.
Depends. Do you have a preference? Because some people, it's like sometimes, you know, like, I don't know.
I have a better shot at getting songs placed, I think, when I'm with an artist. I guess it depends on who the artist is.
Yeah.
But I think the fewer writers you have in a room, the better shot. Let me phrase it like this. If you add writers to a session, you add third, fourth, fifth writer, I don't think that increases your odds of having a hit.
I think it does the opposite.
I think it does the opposite. And I think...
Like, I've never functioned in camps well.
Right. Well, but either you do it because it's just a blast and you're like, okay, so today's just fun. And if we nail something because 11 of us are yelling in a room, that's fun.
Yeah.
But on some level, I like that I go into a room with one person and we struggle through a song, but it doesn't sound like... It won't have the homogeny that you get from having too many opinions. It won't turn vanilla because... When you have five people who all have to agree on a song, on each lyric and each melody, it's going to get more and more vanilla the more opinions you get.
Yeah.
So I like the vulnerability of a fewer writers. And, you know, so I think that's been part of what I've been trying to do is to find people I feel most vulnerable, that I can be vulnerable with.
Johan's
a writer.
Guy, right?
Yeah, Johan and I've done a lot of, like, I mean, we've had probably 20, 30 decent sized cuts together. So,
favorite song you've written?
What's my favorite song?
Yeah, like what's the one that when you're dead?
Yeah. When I'm dead.
What's the one that they play at your funeral? Just so far?
To be honest,
what are you most proud of?
I'm really excited that I recorded The Wrong Man. I feel like if I die on my way home, which I hope doesn't happen because it's going to be a weird interview if it does.
That's the one
but
that we should listen
if
to.
If it does, whatever state it's in, and
put
however you hear it, listen to it.
Okay.
Because I think you'll really get, it's not only has it spanned 12 years of writing.
Yeah.
So some of the songs are that old, some of them are that new, but it gets my sense of humor, it gets my politics, it gets my, it shows my, it's really doesn't seem like I'm the character. It seems like there is a character in it. I'm just proud of it.
Yeah.
To me, I think that exemplifies everything I've worked for as a song crafter. To me, that feels like an opus.
Well, that's interesting you say that. That's what I love about songwriters so much is I've never met a songwriter who's just like, oh, I just wrote that song. Like, I feel like every song is, there's, you just take out a new funnel and you're like, I want to put it all in, have the best song ever. And then you do that, and then you put that funnel into a funnel. It's like, it's such a, there's nothing that, I don't know, don't you feel that way? Like, they're just, everything is quite intentionally the best song that you've got in you.
Yeah, I think so. Well, certainly at the moment, I mean, I like that I can point to songs and they kind of exemplify a moment in my life. What's the song that when you die, you're like, oh yeah, that's the song that I should be remembered for? It can be a body of work, because I mean, I threw that out.
a Steel Train song called Dakota. I think it's like a very...
Wow.
Perfect song, now that I have some perspective on it. About a made-up place called Dakota. And it's like little stories about horrible things. And in Dakota, one day you will wake up unchanged, is the hook. But I was really bad at hooks when I was in that band. Like, I was very into complicating things. It's crazy how hard it is still. Every day, yesterday, I worked on something. I just listened to it, and I was like, stop it. Stop complicating it. you know, it's crazy how hard it is when you're in there to just say it. It's like the ESL thing, or it's like being in therapy. It's like just saying it. It's so easy, especially as like a Jew, to like have a million words and say this and say that, but to like just say it. Like, and that's always the hook when you like fully are broken and you just say something.
I think that's where when you having a good co-writer and someone that you love writing with. That's what I was saying. Like, someone that I can trust being vulnerable with, just one-on-one. That's where I'm going to be like, that's where I'm going to be the best writer, is when I can, where I can go and just say it and not feel really weird about it.
Yeah. No one's going to be like, ugh.
Like,
what?
I mean, I can come in with a song called Dangerous Woman on acoustic guitar, and Johan's going to be like, immediately jumps to the piano, is like, all right, let's make it happen.
Well, that's my
and
favorite.
We've done that so many times.
Dare to Suck.
That's
the greatest contribution.
Yeah, sure.
What's your, what pisses you off the most about what we do?
What we do?
Yeah, like the industry, and just like what do you think is like fucking like...
The chasing the trends thing's really hard for me.
Mm-hmm. Because you feel like it's just...
Well, I just don't
not
know
why
if
you're
I,
here.
I don't know if it's not... It's I don't really care, like, irrelevant of me. You know, I think that... I think a lot of great songs get passed up. Like, there's no woman right now who sounds like... You know, like Jewel or Sheryl Crow or Alanis Morissette or anything like that in pop music. And there's no, you know, there are very few bands right now that really get to play in the pop music world. And the idea of the chop vocal basically being the dubstep of 2017, you know, if the drop in quotes was last year's thing. You know, that idea of writing where you basically just say, I don't know, put a drop in there.
Yeah.
Or the minute you hear somebody throw in that chop and you're like, oh, it just sounds so relevant.
Yeah.
And it's like you have this short window of pitching this song and hoping someone cuts it. It's just like, it makes me sad. Because no one ever wrote a song and thought,
I hope this is forgotten next year.
Yeah, but...
Well, because that's what the art of songwriting, to me and to everyone I know, is essentially like, which goes back to how we started talking at the beginning of this about the absurdity of legacy, but essentially it's like, to quote you, if I die on the way home today, check this out.
Yeah.
If I die on the way home today, check out my new EP. but seriously, check this out, because it's more, it's the closest I can get to, you know, putting my heart and soul into
absolutely
something you can hear.
I want you to hear the sweat that it took and the months it took per song. You know, I want people to listen to something and have it seem so simple and have no idea how difficult that process was.
Totally.
But like, you just know it. You just know when people, when I hear about some guy, like when you hear about Lin-Manuel freestyle, like you see him freestyle or something, you're like, is that really a freestyle? You see like those Eminem freestyles, you're like, is that really a freestyle? Like, are they really that genius? And maybe there are people who are that genius. I assume they are. It's like a magic trick to me, you know?
Well, I'm so not a freestyle type. Like, everything takes me so long, and
Right. So it's the total editing.
Yeah, it's like what if and what if you took all that out and what if that was and what if that was it? Yeah. And what if it was just that?
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing this. You know, I like that you are constantly wearing your heart on your sleeve in social media, in your music, and you represent songwriters and artists and producers really well. And that to have somebody that when you know that you have a song come out, it's like when you see a movie and it's that actor that you really like. You know, it's exciting because you know that it's going to be something that's unexpected and you know it's going to be something that isn't going to be cookie cutter and it won't be chasing trends and it'll be you.
Well, that's my new goal now is don't let Ross down.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, I'll be judging you. So thank you again.
Thanks for having me. All
right.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silberstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.